And so the Russians would pick them up there, and then they'd fly to Nome, and then over into Russia. And that it was that movement of those fighting planes that we got in there and helped win the war, because Hitler had turned on his ally, and so he was ours, and we had to defeat him. And you see, so they get the fighter planes there, and England, we were tied up by the submarines here. So President Roosevelt, he did something out of line, whether it was legal or not. He lend-leased these boats to England, see, and it was wholly a part of the fight. But the reason for the Alaska Highway, we'd wanted it and all. But when they started this movement of the planes, they found that those young officers with no air aids of the navigation on the ground and very poor, could be not much more with blunt compasses up at the cockpit to govern themselves. If that young, inexperienced pilot didn't calculate his wind drift correctly, he would be off course when he ran out of gasoline. And so they started the Alaska Highway, and as they looked down, they didn't need a compass because I'm on the ground. So that is how we got the Alaska Highway, and out of the many interesting things that happened. But if you ever travel the Alaska Highway and want to make inquiry, you will find on this every 100 miles along on the Alaska Highway, there's a landing strip. That was because of the ships were going through there.
So it took a war to get the highway.
Well, yes, and almost all of these things, it took the war. So there's nothing so bad when it's good for something. And we ended up, you see, but that is the kind of things that happen. And so on this trip that I was going in to see General Buckner and to talk to him, but I was flagged down at Whitehorse, where the Canadian command was on, and that American officer there, he had me flagged down and wanted me to go to Edmonton because they had an unruly colonel there. And the general couldn't control it, you see, because I don't know, the general may not have been a West Pointer. This guy was from a long line of West Pointers. So he was there, and of course, when I saw him, it's funny when I think of it, because I was angry. I'd been called on off of what I wanted to go in there, and it was so cold. We didn't have crate, but we had our sleeping bags, but it was cold, and landed in Edmonton at 2 in the morning with no reservations or anything else to get into a hotel. So I was in no mood to take anything from a colonel or anything, so I went to see this guy. Oh, yo, sure. This was he had to use dogs. His gestures were going over to the side, and finally I saw he had a bunch of pictures of sled dogs in there. And are you telling me that this is important, that you need the dogs? I said, you're on rivers here, and now those dogs, the way you've taken the pictures and everything, they're having fun. You're using them with the nurses and everything to give them dog rides, but you're trying to use it as they have dogs. I said, because if you're driving dogs, they're never with their curls tailed up. They're in there working. And it wouldn't be on open ground usually in Alaska when it's frozen. You follow the rivers and find it. And you get along because that's the route taken. It's frozen and you build up good. And then you usually have trees on the side, so if you're down, you could build a fire and stuff. So he was all off. But it didn't do much good. It did some good, but here to go. But out of that same trip then, when I came back, I did go to see General Buckner. And General Buckner was good, but his chief of staff was there. And I talked to him, and my mission among the missions I was to, by Governor Greening, was to go to Matanuska and talk to the farmers in there, because they weren't able to sell their potatoes. They needed $4, $4 was the base thing. And they couldn't, because they could buy them with $2, the base thing, in Yakima. So they bought on a contract for Yakima, and they were bringing the cost of bringing in, and the railroad was broken down. War material should have been used. We should have been using our own stuff, but we're bringing coal from Utah was coming on out and going on up into here, and the same thing with agriculture people. But as the war when the war ended, out of this war thing, I had talked to this this colonel, this chief of the staff there, because Buckner was gone. He said, "What would you do if you had any say? I would take those tanks that you got." And I would take, there's a lot of plows and farm machinery abandoned by the teamsters and old abandoned houses. I would take those, pull it with a tank or something else, and throw the harrows, and every third harrow should take some thickly peeled potato peelings, and then you'd get crazy. But after the war, the surplus property came on. All of this, they had ordered the best of farm equipment that was up for surplus, you see, when it could have been used by farmers in the States. It was in the warehouse there, to potato planters, potato diggers, and the whole set of stuff. We found that they finally got them on the surplus property. You see, the farmers did get them, but during the war, when they needed them in the States and stuff, they were in the warehouse here, because I had suggested it be done, you see. But in my crazy way, you know, you could, if the enemy came in here and blockaded, we would have potatoes, and then with our moose and caribou and reindeer, we could supply. Mm-hmm. And that's among the funny things that happened. There were many amusing things like that. But now, as this went on and handling the whole thing, you know, I had to go along and I'd take congressional parties. I'd have to take them, and they'd want to go from here to there. And it was usually, they come into Fairbanks or Anchorage, and they want to hit either one of them. And then they want to go to Point Barrow and Kotzebue and Nome and down to Naknek and so forth and Kodiak and make that trip. Well, we don't have taxis in either place, and we don't control the weather. So I went over to Nate Twining, who was then in town, and I said, "Nate, we've got these congressional people. They got a steady route and stuff. Why couldn't your officers have got to have so much flying time. Why couldn't they take a DC-2 or DC-3 and take our group and let us go the route that they wanted to go?" In other words, it became a private plane. Well, he agreed that it was good. So this place would usually have two officers in there, and then the rest, there were bucket seats on the side where we could sit in, and then there was usually a sergeant in there who had some sandwiches and coffee that he could pass on the way, and we'd go into. Well, anyhow, as we came into these villages, you know, the congressmen and the people of Alaska, you know, wanted, you might say, the Chambers of Commerce, whatever their committee was about, they would throw a big party. Alaskans always do. And so they could have the meeting. Well, since I was an Alaskan and know this whole thing, the crew was invited. Here were military people invited, and they were in. it was so nice that they were competing for these jobs when they went around, because they had a good tour. They knew they were doing something that was worthwhile, but also they were in on these meetings, see, because when the meetings, come on in, food and voice and everything else. The Alaskans, how many do you have on your plane? And they said, took care of them. And so this turned out to be, but there were those things that knowing Alaska and Will Godding, who knew it, and Greening that knew it, and Bob Bartlett that knew it, we had plenty of people that knew it, but we didn't have the ability until things would happen, who's the Rasmussen? The banker came on in, and see, they began to reach out, and we were treated by laws of Congress that had overlooked. And when the law was passed, it was worded so it applied to the territories and island possessions. This had opened up, spread what Congress had thought of before. It had only been the 48 states and the District of Columbia. And that was the law, and you couldn't go beyond it. You see. So these things were turned out so good. And many funny things and worthwhile things happened out of this thing with the handling of the surplus property and the wanting to build this stuff, you know. So, but the Alaska Highway, we'd wanted a highway all the way through, but we couldn't get it. But then, of course, it came into being.
Well, I guess up until then, the only way you would get things would be by ship.
By ship was the only way.
And that was a monopoly.
No, there were no airplanes, and what's more, there were no telephone. The only communication we had was the signal corps, telegraphs we go to. Mm-hmm. Now, on that telegraph thing, again, this goes a little further on, but my job then with the War Manpower Commission, or the Office of Territories, the War Manpower Commission, I was in Rashad, and so the thing was to let Alaskans work, but the cost plus fixed fee and the contractors and the unions had worked it out that we, the Alaskans, had to go to Seattle to sign up there with the union and were hired out, as they said, before they could go back. And while they were there, they got the 48 hours a week pay while they were in the hotel at the scale of their craft. Sometimes they'd be there for 2 or 3 weeks before they went. And this was that silly period then where that general made us go through immigration. We couldn't go through immigration. And with that, I had to set up an office in Seattle, because I had to be most of the time, and I had Mrs. Carter, a wonderful lady, and unfortunately, through the employment service, she got a person, and that person, the grandest little girl that I ever know. And that is, she is now Dorothy Herring Beislein.
Oh.
I had lunch with them today, that girl, this is the funny thing coming back, we'll lead into sometime, I hope, to women's stuff. But women, because of my mother and in the employment service, knowing that women did not get the breaks, you see, it wasn't going. So I had the authority, and I put women on jobs because there was a shortage of jobs that they never held before. And they started to get into the money. And of course, I had learned that by buying my assistants, getting my assistants, if they were women, they were just worth far more than men, because men, if they had a job kind of officially, they're big shots, and they might go in and tell the secretary that they'd be busy. Well, the busyness was reading the morning paper.
drinking a cup of coffee.
Yeah, and get them a cup of coffee. So, so many funny things. But it all has a good end on it. But when I went to see when this Sitka, which was an old town, and they had good AFL carpet craftsmen, you know, and as did Juno and everything else, to build in Sitka, the Sitka people had to go to Seattle with the unions there to get a job back to their old place, and then in the meantime,
this
they
is
had
all
to,
because of territorial status.
Yeah, because of territorial
so
status.
That was another vote for becoming a state.
Yes. There was no end to it. Mm-hmm. This is this.
You really
is,
needed a wide array of people to support.
Well, you needed it, you see, and this is the way it came about. So, well, it could go on and you name it, and I could show you how we use the women. We were talking about the women that mentally ill, not necessarily mentally ill, mentally disturbed people that were sent to the crazy house for mentally, but it was
so
just
they had the mentally ill problem.
Yeah, what you'd call it, mental disturbance, mm-hmm. were a little bit of care. Doctors talking to them and probably a little aspirin
and
stuff.
Yeah, we can all use a little of that today.
Yeah. So those were the things that they came. But and of course, this and things of my mother and stuff, that's what led me into working for the women's mm-hmm. rights. Mm-hmm. And it was in chief of the Oscar Brands and all of these other things that were going mm-hmm. that I read the book, Jailed for Freedom, by Stevens. Mm-hmm. And I found then that women who would walk the streets of D.C. try to get the right mm-hmm. to vote. They were imprisoned criminally abused in there. You know, poor, filthy food and clothing and everything else. They were like criminals rather than political persons. And so it finally, and when I learned this, then I thought, well, because we had the mental hospital in there, and why should that not be posted? And I used the thing is, why should they have a history mark to place a fort in Carolina that fired a cannon that started the Civil War? Why shouldn't we have a historical marker for the women that were incarcerated and brutal right at my own Lorton Reformatory.
Right.
Yeah.
Where you live now.
So, and so from Alaska, knowing this and reading that, but then again it was, what to do about it, see, it was just... It came about, and there were so many things that one could do to bring us. It was the right thing to do, and it worked out. And out of that, that I had the experience here, mm-hmm. then I went to learn. And so people, Joe, get it. That's good. You ought to do it. But I learned I could join the League of Women Voters, and then we went in, and they took a hold, and they did it. And working together, a lot of work, because you had to get permission to several others that it would get historic recognition. Mm-hmm. And it was a lot of work, but the women did that, and we got that historic marker right there on Highway 26.
So you're an activist from way back.
Yeah, no. Well, it goes way back, because... Mm-hmm. With my mother, you see, a wonderful mother, and this is the base for everything. Because mm-hmm. I saw what she put up with. My dad was a successful Norwegian. He came from Norway, and he became rich. to the building of the Alaska Railroad, not the Alaska Railroad, the Transcontinental Railroad, the Northwest, Northern, Great Northern.
Great Northern. With
Jim Hill, because a lot of people don't know it, but the government, to get these right, they gave the railroad every other township of land, the right from ocean to ocean, to build the Transcontinental land. That was the financing of it. So the railroad people then were anxious to have the settlers in to get, so as they built here, as they could move them out forward, you see, that. So they were very liberal in their, more liberal than our Homestead Act was. So one of the simple things in the area, the Red River Valley of the North, where he worked on it, one of the simple things that you could lot, build a drink and have an artesian well. And you could drive down, and then the water would come, you see, and that's what the farmer needed. And those artesian wells, I know one of them that still, it isn't flowing much, but it's providing, it comes on in here now, and they pump it into it, the system, and they have good, we call it spring water in there. So those artesian wells, but it used to be they'd come up, usually run them up about, say, 3 feet above ground, put an elbow on, and then it would go, if they had cover for the building. The first one would be a small little tank where you could do pitcher full of water, a bucket full. Then from that, it would go into a larger tank where you'd keep your butter and your cream and everything else. And from that, it'd go into the third bigger one where the wash clothes could be. And then from that out into the cattle tank.
It was,
No. This was standard stuff. And it was necessary for the farms in there. But Dad was so successful in that they called him a millionaire. He never was a millionaire. I heard him say that. But he became an alcoholic. And he didn't know, and they didn't know in those days, that it was a disease. They thought it was a weakness. Dad was not weak. He was strong, but he didn't know that he had this disease. So we sold out the auction sale, and they sold everything that they had. And he went into Minneapolis because he dealt as a sideline of real estate and so he thought he'd go get away from the people and no problem to it. But of course that did, it wasn't the place. It went from bad to worse until it got so darn bad that we had to go into the Red River Valley. They drained some lakes in there, and so there would be farmlands rather. And so Dad found that there were some fractions of land on the border of this mud lake. And by taking them, homesteading that, when the land was divided like a piece of pie, it would have cut on off and it would have had 700 acres on it. But it didn't go that way for several reasons. And that was tough stuff. And the family went from there to going to go to the homestead. And in Thief River Falls, was the problem of getting teamsters in there, and I suppose there were many. Maybe one was Dad and his alcohol problem, but the thing was to get a farmer with two wagons that could take our household goods and us out there. Well, after 2 months, and during those 2 months in there, here's where Mother comes in again. All she had to live on was she'd wake it, my brother and I up at sunrise, and then we go wherever people would be, and everything was reusable, that whiskey bottles, milk bottles, anything. And so behind the saloons, down at the depot, in the parks, and down on the banks of the river where there might have been fishing, there might be bottles, and we'd pick that up, and they would be turned in. And Mother then would use that money and for food for we kids, and much of it would be boiled eggs because she could get a good food, and the maids, feeling sorry for this mother, would take the eggs and they'd take them down and they'd boil them. We had a lot of boiled eggs. But Mother had, that's what we lived on for about 2 months. Now finally, when Dad was able to get a farmer with two farm wagons, it took that for our household goods to bring it. We started out. Now, our homestead was 22 miles by the roads of that time and around the lakes and stuff that we had to go. It was 22 miles. It took us 2 days to go those 22 miles. Bog, the horses would bog down and the thing was there. And then when we were finally stranded on the, we fought mosquitoes that first night. And you fought them all the way along, but you get used to them. But the shanty, 14 by 16 shanty, mm-hmm. with green shiplap on it. So there were big cracks in it. Mm-hmm. So when the morning, when the Teamsters left, Dad went with him, with the thought, you know, because he was dealing in alcohol, or not alcohol, yes. but real estate, and he had quite a bit of real estate to sell and dispose of, you see, so he'd be going along, but they left, and their mother was left on that prairie with that 14 by 16 shanty, and the only things that we had in there were three hens and a rooster and a bitch puppy that we kids had picked up. That's all we had, and they were off. So we had to live off the country, and there's where the mother came on in, you know, and never anything but there was never anything but the God, good Lord moves in mysterious ways. There's nothing so bad what is good, good for something, and live by the golden rule. Those were the things she kept telling us all the time, and she worked too. But there she had we kids on her mind now. It happened that some of the old river beds and the lake beds would have pools yet. It had all drilled away, so you could go there and there'd be still some fish that you could almost pick out of the salt water. That was one of the sources of food. And then she had some of these, this wire that you use for snares, or we use it for snares, but hanging up pictures, you see.
Picture wire.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so we'd make snares out of that and hang it over the rabbit runs, and it would catch rabbits.
And,
and then, of course, there were in season, there'd be the choke cherries, and then well, they call them blueberries, but actually they're better than that. They were the lingonberries, and they were quite plentiful, and then for a period in the summer, there were raspberries, wild raspberries. So, of course, mother, all this. But there that lady was with these kids, and we lived off the country. That's mm-hmm. all we had.
Yeah, it really prepared you for dealing with Alaska.
Well, no, the whole my whole life.
But your whole life is influenced
yeah, because
by that.
Then show you what my mother, one day she talked to us and she said, "Now listen to Mabel," that's my sister that was older. She says, "Behave yourself because I'm going into town." And she did. Now that was 14 miles into Holt, the way they went in those days. Mm-hmm. And then she started off with a gunny sack and a piece of clothesline. She walked on in and came back. That would have been 28 miles that she went that day. And when she came back, and with that gunny sack, she'd arranged for credit and gotten this necessary food. Coming back with just that clothesline over here, this was just flesh that you saw when it burned. You know, it was awful, but that's what mothers will do for their families. So those were the things, you know, that she put up with. And of course, the fight for schools and everything. It was a tough going, but we took it as it was, you see. That's all we knew. We had no money or anything else, and the only fun that we would have, but if someone did something or we could frame on doing something that we could laugh at, that's what we would do. But, and then Mother, you know, strong Northern Lutheran, you know, we said our prayers and everything else. She was just so great that this was the way. And then, you know, if you want, people want to say why I know I'm going to heaven and everything, because I know there is a hereafter, and I believe what Mother said, live by the golden rule and so forth. But one Sunday morning, she said, put on the woolen clothing, get some buckets and gunny sacks, because there's a prairie fire coming. And here the prayer fire come, probably, I believe, you call it a 10-mile front. Mm-hmm. And the grasses in there were thick and at least 3 to 4 feet high. And with the cane breaks, it would be 8 weeks. And so it was coming. Now, what had happened? Mother had asked her brother to, if she'd loan her money so we could get a cow. And weak children learn, you see, that with Mother, that a cow should, according to the farm records, need 4 tons of hay a year. So with scythe and stuff, and a pair of buggy wheels that we rigged a cart on, we hauled it on over. So we had, say, here was 1 mound of hay. Here was another, and that way, out here for 3. Now, if we had those 3 mounds of hay with a little better than a ton each, we'd have 4 ton. Now, so with the side, we cut the hay, and then we would wheel them all over, put it on here, and then here and here. Now, there was grass on this side, because then we'd cut for this way, and we'd have only half, it'd be in the middle of it. But when that fire came, then it was out there, and we, for the first one that close on the oncoming fire, we started a backfire, and that was easy. Start a backfire, you know, and it ran away from it, you know, and it was easy to control. But by the time the second one, it was really pouring in on us, you see, and so that was really when you fought. We got by with that second mound of hay, but the third one was just there, and the fires were really licking at the bottom of the stack. Mother disturbed, and while she wasn't afraid of Dad, because Dad was one to be, but she knew that in the alcoholism, he might be, you know, blame us to say we hadn't saved that stack. Mm. Mother fell down and prayed. The stack was there when it was black all around. Now, no one can tell me
there wasn't
a sewer power. Now, another time, a neighbor there at the homestead, a neighbor called him, you see, they were usually 2 or 3 miles apart. And walkers, she was sick, and they asked if we would take and stay at their place, and it was the only place in the area that had really a truly built house and a truly built barn, and they had a well and everything else. And we were only 1/4 mile from the school where we were. We were 2 miles away.
Sure.
So we went into this good facility. But Mother then, she was sick there, and I remember her lying in bed and praying, you know, that she might live to be with the children. She was moaning, and I guess it was a kidney stone or something that she had to go through with. But it happened. She came out of it. And when after World War I, then we moved into Minneapolis, getting her away. No divorce would Dad, but he'd been picking on one after the other till with the war over, and two of my brothers back, one from the Army and the other one from the Marine Corps, and sis coming in, we got together and we rented a house. We called it an apartment. It was the upstairs, but it was real nice. And things were nice for mother. But then she had a skin infection in her fingers here. And they called it eczema. But I think the real name of it was myxedema or some other fluke. But she wasn't getting any help from the doctors. And then they said, try to Minnesota, the University of Minnesota Hospital. And she went over, my brother and my sister took the streetcar and took her over there. And the doctor was interested in her. And he said, now I'm going to Chicago to a convention, and the subject that we're studying is just this. And he said, if I find some, I would like it if you'd come in and stay with the hospital so we could practice. And it turned out that way. When he came back, he felt he had something, and we didn't have a phone, but he called the neighbor, and the neighbor got us to, and sis and my brother took mother by streetcar to the hospital. Then she was, we were to get her, and went over there, and her room was quarantined because of scarlet fever. The other patient had scarlet fever. And then when that was lifted, they went back. But when they came back, it was because mother then had it.
Oh, dear.
So then another stiff. Now then, when it went back there to see her, but that morning when she came there, she was paralyzed from here down. But as a result of the sickness, you see, she was paralyzed. Mm-hmm. Now, then, right there, she wanted to go to heaven. And she said, now take care of the two younger children. That is, I was the third, but 2 younger than me, mm-hmm. about 2 years between each one of them. Mm-hmm. To see that we got through school.
So you all got through school?
Well, we did to a point. Yes, well, as far as is concerned, her wish was carried forward, but it took some tough going. But it was all good, particularly this young brother, the youngest one. He knew and loved mother so much that he did something that most would say wouldn't happen. He did go and study to the necessary courses and stuff to pass the course and become a member of the church. He's being confirmed.
She would be pleased.
He did that just because we had no clout to do it, but he knew mother, and he did. My other brother didn't. I never did. Now, the reason we didn't is, all this can be so funny, and I'm getting off course, but it's a part of the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Dad and mother were strong Norwegian Lutherans, and the Bible was at the table, and Dad would read from it, and we'd say grace and everything else in Sunday school and church. They were the leaders in the church, everything was fine until the alcoholism, and we ended up in Minneapolis. But then, and how we didn't, what happened, we lived out there, and it was a young medical...
So your early life certainly prepared you and influenced you for your life in Alaska, and I think you can see what efforts people like you have, what the results have been, and it's certainly not the Alaska that you knew first in 1929. A lot of changes, I'm sure you would agree, for the better, and it's a very nice place to live, and I thank you for playing such an important part in Alaska history, and I'm one of the recipients of pioneers such as yourself. Thank you.